I am rolling.
Excuse me. Choked on my coffee there. Okay, I promise it's not going to be as long as last week where word association was an hour. Thanks to everyone who stuck with it. Bless you. Bless you.
But before we start word association, there's one thing we have to do first.
What's that?
So I got a call from the general manager of the Minnesota Wild, Bill Guerin, who did not like something that was said in last week's podcast. And we were talking about the Eric Staal deal, and there was one thing that he took issue with.
Okay.
And that is the idea that Eric Staal found out about the trade via Twitter. When the trade broke on Twitter, his phone blew up. And that's what I'd heard, and that's what I'd mentioned. And Bill Guerin said that, look, the call happened at 4:02 Minnesota time. The call finished at 4:08 Minnesota time. And he said he contacted Eric Staal at 4:09 Minnesota time. And he said, look, people can disagree with me as much as they want, but I would not treat a player like that. So he wanted to say that. So I figured we should start the podcast with that.
All right. Very good. Maybe the busiest general manager in this offseason so far, Bill Guerin. Okay, let's kick it off with word association. Last week was, what would the term be, Elliot? Self-indulgent, perhaps? We'll make it a little more brief this time around.
Okay, yeah, it was too long.
Too self-indulgent.
I can really listen to myself talk for a long time because let's admit, it's pure genius.
Oh, brother.
But I even felt that that was too much.
Today's episode will be called Elliot Friedman. Oh, look, there's my navel. Let's kick it off with Jay Bomeister.
How many times do you play World Juniors?
Oh, boy.
The funniest Jay Bomeister story I have is when I was doing a sit down with him when he was a member of the World Juniors. And he's not the most talkative guy. I said to him, can you tell us how you pronounce your name? And Jay Bomeister was so quiet, he said it on tape, and we were still arguing about it because it wasn't clear the way he said it. Like, I brought it into a room, and we showed all the guys at the score, here's how Jay Bomeister pronounces his name. And we looked at it, and we said, he didn't clear anything up here because it was so hard to tell because he speaks so softly.
Yeah.
It was a pretty funny scene, actually. I remember laughing my head off at it. But you know what? I'll say this. The most talkative he ever was when the Blues won the Stanley Cup. Nick and I were outside of their room quickly. We wanted to get away, but we were just wishing congratulations to a couple players we knew. And Bomeister walked up to us. And he started talking to us and, you know, it was a great conversation. You know, I've always heard he was a really smart guy who had a lot of really good insight into the games, but he just didn't really share it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when it was over, Nick and I were kind of looking at each other like, we've never talked to him for so long. And he said to Nick, I know you picked us at the beginning of the year. And Nick was really flattered by that. You know, he asked me about some of the things I'd written over the year. And I go, you read this stuff? And he goes, I read everything. And it was just really interesting. We got to see like sort of the personal side of him a little bit. And you wish him all the best. You know, unfortunately, because of the heart condition, it looks like his career is over. But some of the exchanges I had with him during the Cup final and after, it's like, wow. Like I've always heard there's this other side to Bomeister, and there it is.
Three consecutive World Juniors. Won a silver and two bronze medals. So three-time World Junior defenseman, Jay Bomeister. And the first thing you always think of is the skating. Just like one of the most graceful skaters.
I didn't want to say generation. That because it was too obvious.
I think you have to at this point. Whenever like someone's skills, like whenever you mention Pavel Bure, you got to say, oh, the speed and the feet are as quick as the hands. And oh, when did we see that? And shoot off both feet. I think you got to at least acknowledge how graceful a skater Jay Bomeister always was. From Jay Bomeister, let's head to Aaron Rome.
I recently did the 2011 oral history of the Vancouver Canucks. And for years, I had tried to speak to Aaron Rome about what happened that series. And for years, he stayed quiet about it. And he finally agreed to talk to me. And it was hard for him. You could tell it was a really difficult conversation. You know, he's still someone who is terribly disappointed by what happened in that series. And after the call was over, I really was appreciative, and I told him I really was appreciative. But, you know, there's sometimes, you know, Jeff, you're talking with someone about a subject that they don't really want to talk about, but they agree to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And when it's over, you're sitting there and you're saying, did I push this too far? You know, it was a tough conversation. And I just feel really badly that, you know, 10 years later, 9 years later, it's still something that bothers him so much. He was playing the best he'd ever played in that series, and Ham Hughes went down. But I do think if Rome stays healthy, he was that much of a difference maker at that time, the way he was playing, that maybe Vancouver wins that series. I feel terribly that is such a major thing to him and to his life. I've heard great things about him as a person. Like, he coaches his kids in hockey. Apparently he's a tremendous guy. I know he's really tight with Mason Raymond, and Raymond and I talked about him a little bit. I just feel terribly about it. I really do. Like, nobody should be that disappointed about something that happened to them. And
yep.
I wish I knew him better, that there was a better story to tell about him. I just heard how emotional he was when he was told about the suspension. People told me they'd never seen anybody react like that before, how disappointed and crushed he was. I just wish there was a better story. I knew a better story about him to tell.
Al McNeil.
Craig Button always told me what a great guy he was. All of a sudden, he was a coach when they had a coaching change in Calgary, and he was the interim guy for a little while. You know, one of the things he didn't like to talk about was a confrontation with Henri Richard. Henri Richard did not like him as a coach and very famously criticized him in French.
Yep.
And it was something that Al McNeil did not like to talk about. As a matter of fact, I did an interview with him once when he was the coach interim in Calgary, and I was told that don't ask him about that. Like, he does not like talking about that.
Hmm.
And by the way, I'm beginning to figure out what this is, and I don't like it.
You don't like what?
I don't like your topic here. I just realized what it is.
It's not me.
No, I know exactly what it is now. Because I knew, you haven't asked me about Freacher yet, and the first thing I thought about was Freacher.
Yeah.
And I just looked up Al McNeil to check a fact on him.
Yeah.
And I see what it is.
It's coming up at the end. Hold on.
Yeah, I see what it is.
There's a story attached to this one. That's why I haven't given out who wrote it in.
Yeah. It's, thanks, Jeff.
All right.
But I you know what? It's like, again, it's like just a really nice man. But I remember that I was told, don't ask him this question because he doesn't like it. AHL Hall of Famer, too.
Yep. Maritime legend, Al McNeil.
Yes.
This is perhaps an obscure name for many, but was involved in a pretty high-profile incident once upon a time back in 82. Paul Mulvey.
Yeah, refused to get off the bench, right?
For a fight. L.A. and Vancouver got the tap from Don Perry and said, no, I'm not jumping over the boards.
When a battle erupted 9 days ago between the Vancouver Canucks and the Los Angeles Kings, it hardly seemed unusual. What made it unusual is that Paul Mulvey of the Kings says Coach Don Perry ordered him to leave the bench, enter the brawl, and instigate violence. Mulvey, 6'4 and 220 pounds, with a reputation as an enforcer, did go on the ice, but was not violent.
$10.
The manager of radio station KQLH in Los Angeles said his station will no longer broadcast the Kings games because of what they did to Mulvey. I say give that station manager a hand. Now here's Mulvey explaining his feelings why he did not join in the brawl.
And trying to make the best of everything, and Kerry and I here are just trying to keep our chins up. And I realize that maybe I have too big of a mouth, and maybe I stuck to those standards too hard. But we're trying our very best, and I've got not only myself now to walk around this world and be respected.
I remember how big a story that was, and I remember how he said it affected the rest of his career.
Didn't play. That was it. Got waived, yeah. Sent down, never played again.
That's a story that I've thought about from time to time. Back then, it cost him his career. What would happen now?
Right now, that would cement his spot on a team. Hang on a second. I mean, there have been other players like Pierre Turgeon in the 87 brawl, the punch up in Piotr Stanny.
Yeah.
Bert Templeton and Pat Burns are behind the bench, and Pierre Turgeon doesn't jump over the boards. So, I mean, it's not a zip.
But he wasn't the only one. There was another player, too. Wasn't Steve Nemeth a guy who was very critical of what they did?
Probably. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm not going to doubt that you're wrong on it.
But yes, in Gare Joyce's excellent book about that brawl.
It's a really good book.
You know, the players were very critical of Turgeon.
Chartrand and Hardy were the two that ended up jumping over the boards to start the brawl with Vancouver. But it was really public. And yeah, it was an enormous story. And if that happens now, then all of a sudden, you know, Paul Mulvey becomes a touch point figure and a touch point person for violence in hockey and the refusal to do so. Essentially what he does is he becomes a modern day Ned Braden. If I can use a Slapshot reference.
And he sued them.
Oh, did he sue them as well?
Yes, he did. He sued them, and there was a settlement because he thought he'd been blacklisted. I remember Perry was suspended, and if I remember the quote correctly, and I'm looking it up here now, he said, "I'm not a designated assassin." And after he got traded to Edmonton, and although he never played again, as you said, and he sued them, and I know there was a settlement involved. It was quite a story. I remember I was 11 years old. I remember that story. I remember the headlines in the paper. And he always claimed, even your dog disagrees with what happened to Mulvey.
He's a German Shepherd. He likes it rough. He didn't like the move, staying on the bench.
And I remember Mulvey's stance on it was nothing was out of control. And he, as you said, he didn't get off the bench until he thought it was out of control or headed to be out of control.
All right, we'll finish on this one because we promised to keep word association brief, and Elliot may have already figured this out. Miroslav Krejčí.
Well, this is how I kind of figured out what you were up to.
Not me. Not me.
Okay, whoever this was up to. I remember Miroslav Krejčí because in his second NHL game, he played for the Quebec Nordiques, and against the Maple Leafs, he had a hat trick. And the Maple Leafs were so impressed that they later traded for him.
Traded Wolf Paymon.
Yes, they traded Wolf Paymon for him. And he was one of my favorite players growing up because of the thread that this ties into. So he wore 14 for the Leafs, and yeah, he was a big scorer, and I loved his game. And, you know, he was just one of those guys who was boom or bust. He either scored or his line gave up 6 goals when he was on the ice. Like he was one of those kinds of guys. And I just remember, I heard from when I started getting into the business and you get asked like, who are your favorite players and things like that. And you said, Mirko Krejčí was one of my favorite guys. And someone who knew the Leafs said, boy, that guy loved to drink.
Yeah.
And, you know, Krejčí talked about some of his issues after his career, about some of the things he really battled. But I always remembered his second NHL game. And he couldn't speak English at the time, if I remember correctly. I think the headline in the paper, and again, sometimes you just remember headlines.
Yeah.
It was something along the lines of, he can't speak English, but one word he knows is score. Because in his second NHL game, he had a hat trick against the Maple Leafs, and eventually the Maple Leafs traded for him.
I still remember the headline in the old Toronto Star weekend insert, The City, Mike Palmateer, cocky in the crease. That had burned into my memory since I was 8 years old.
It's funny what you remember. Eh?
You know what's funny? And I just found that old magazine when I was cleaning up the basement last summer. Okay, so this comes to us from Mitchell Taylor at Skeets_21. Mitchell Taylor was the gentleman who sent in the yellow laces thread.
Oh my God.
And he said, I want to get back on Elliot's good side. So I put this one together. Elliot, what's the theme?
Mitchell, it's very kind of you. I have to say, I'm not crazy about this kind of information being public because I like to go under the radar on such things. You could have added Mike Schmidt to this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you could have added former Toronto Argonaut Receiver Yan Sorensi. He won a Grey Cup with the Argonauts in 1982 when they broke their 31-year Grey Cup-less streak. But all of these people, I didn't know that it was Bouwmeester. I actually did not know that it was this was him too.
Yeah.
All of these guys were born on September the 27th, which is my birthday too.
Well, he did add a few other names, but I sort of condensed it for brevity because of last year's self and Dodgers. So he also had Ryan Murray.
Really?
Damon Lankow.
Okay.
Dennis Kearns, who I'll always remember getting popped tough behind guy. The Bruins net by Bob Probert.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Cowan.
Hmm.
Wally Boyer. And then the aforementioned Miroslav Krejčí. So that was the 10 that he submitted, but I sort of edited this thing for brevity this week.
That's how I kind of clued in that this was interesting, because Krejčí was one of my favorite players because of that game and because I recognized that we shared the same birthday.
Do you remember when Krejčí flipped John Brophy the bird?
Yes, it got kicked out of practice.
So Brophy hated him. He gets moved. He ends up on the Detroit Red Wings, scores two goals against the Maple Leafs, skates by the Maple Leafs bench,
mm-hmm.
and gives John Brophy the finger.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's a great story about one of your favorite hockey players there, and the theme is Elliot Friedman's birthday.
I remember he got kicked out of practice, and that was like near the end of his time in Toronto.
Yep.
I didn't remember he did that in the game until you just mentioned it.
All right.
That's hilarious.
There we go. September 27th is the theme, so that's from Mitchell Taylor, who feels bad about the Yellow Laces one that still angers you to this day. So hopefully Elliot's in a better mood this week as we kick off 31 Thoughts, the podcast. News, information, and Kyle Wellwood still to come on this week's edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast.
Mitch, I just want you to know, like, I wasn't mad at you. I always appreciate everybody who sends in ideas and thoughts. Jeff Merrick's Yellow Laces stuff just makes me bananas. So it's Merrick's fault. It's not yours.
Dude, I could go even deeper than Yellow Laces. We've had some doozies. My DMs, DMs are full of ones that even I shake my head at and say, oof.
Like, okay, so next week, give me one of those.
You want one of those? Because there's like, yeah. Put it this way, when even I'm saying, whoa, that's too much, like, hey, back off, guy, like, then you know it's really something that would annoy you. But if you want to.
So next week, let's make everybody laugh. Give me an annoying one.
Okay, next week, you get an annoying one. Welcome to 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Want to start off with a question for you, Elliot. So Leon Draisaitl picks up the Hart and the Ted Lindsay. So we had Leon Draisaitl on Hockey Central on Wednesday, and my first question to him was, which would you rather have, if you could only have one, the Hart or the Ted Lindsay, which would you choose? What do you think he said?
I would say he says the Ted Lindsay.
100% correct.
Obviously, I'm very proud and, you know, fortunate, happy to have won both, but you know, obviously, I respect both voters, but I mean, you know, obviously the ones from our guys, the guys that you play against every night,
sure,
guys that you play with, just means a lot. You know, it kind of shows me that they appreciate my work and obviously think that I'm a halfway decent player. So, yeah, that one is special for sure.
He's a player, right?
Well, and that's what he said, like the respect of your teammates, the respect of your peers. We spend so much time talking about the Hart and what it means and professional hockey writers and, you know, voting on this thing. And it's a big prestigious award. And I'm willing to bet that if you ask any of the winners of the Hart who have also won the Ted Lindsay to choose, they would probably all say the Ted Lindsay because it's respect of their peers.
I would say most of them would. And we've talked about this at times, Jeff. I think there's sometimes a disconnect with what I don't think at times we, and I'm talking about media and fans, both groups, don't think critically enough or don't try to investigate enough what players think and how players feel. Like during the last series, Dallas beats Vegas and Tyler Seguin says, he's asked,
yeah, Tyler, I'm sure you guys don't care about the numbers. You're the first team to go to the Stanley Cup with a negative goal differential since like 1968. You get outshot all the time. You know, the possession numbers aren't any good, and you end up winning all the time. What's that? What does all that say about your team?
It says analytics are overrated. no, I mean, it just says we find ways. We don't care. You know, in Colorado, it was kind of a goal scoring match, and in this series, it's kind of more of our style of a 1-0, 2-1, 3-2, whatever may be match. So whatever the game brings to us, it's how we're going to play. And, you know, we just find ways to get the job done.
It says that analytics don't matter. And I'm looking at this tweet and I'm like, oh my God, I have to log off right now. I can't put up with this tonight. And sure enough, it was this.
Yeah.
Another stupid debate about analytics in hockey.
Yeah.
You know, Kelly Rudy, he always would say, there was only one stat that matters to me, and that stat is the W, wins. He says, as a player, that's all I cared about. Yes, he would work to improve his game, and you know Kelly, he's a competitive as hell guy.
Oh, yeah.
But at the end of the day, the only stat that mattered to him was the W. And I really think that if you are going to be successful, you have to understand the mentality of the player. They're the one who knows firsthand how hard it is. They're the one who's out there competing and spilling blood. You have to understand that that's what they think about. W. Did we win or did we lose? And plus, you know, they're working on, the great ones are always working on their craft and being competitive and things like that. So when Leon Draisaitl says that, or anyone else, it's because they understand the player mentality, and that, like, he's getting votes from all the people who think like he does and competes and spills blood like he does and knows how hard to win it is like he does. And that's why I think, like, you know, when I look at the whole analytic debate, and I have all sorts of room for the different ideas, I think that one of the things that gets left out, I don't think you can be a successful general manager or coach or organization without this, is understanding the way the players think. And what Tyler Seguin is saying to you is, it is so hard to get here. And we don't care how we got here, mm-hmm. We're here. And that's the way the players think. And you have to understand that.
We've talked about this before. The one thing you can never do to a player is lie. Players know who's good. Players know who's not good. Players know who belongs. Players know who doesn't belong. Players know who's elite.
You can't fool them.
You can't. And listen, you know what? You see it at every single level of hockey. At every single level of hockey, no matter how old, how veteran, or how young. Going right into a minor or youth hockey as well. Players know. Like, you can't lie to a player. And with Leon Draisaitl picking up these two awards this past week, it's once again reignited the conversation about the rise of German hockey in the NHL. And look, Tim Stützle may end up being the highest drafted German player ever if LA selects him second overall. Leon Draisaitl, of course, went third to the Edmonton Oilers. And Brian Brooks made this point for a lot of years, you know, a very athletic country, excel at a lot of different sports, and now they've really started to turn their attention to hockey. And we saw this last year with Moritz Seider, who gets drafted by the Detroit Red Wings. This year it's Tim Stützle, who's going to go high, either second or third overall. Leon Draisaitl is top of the heap right now. Over the past 10 or 15 years, there have been two countries that have really risen internationally. One is Switzerland and the other is Germany. Do you have a thought on German hockey right now?
The number one thing I think of when I listen to what you just said was our conversation a couple of weeks ago about growing. And you mentioned Slovakia.
Yeah.
A country that is right there, and how we're worried about the future there. And you're worried about the future of hockey in the Czech Republic and certain places around the world. And we talked about even in Canada, you're worried about it. And that's why it's so important to hear those stories. You know, I remember talking to Marco Sturm after Germany won the silver at the 2018 Olympics, how hockey players were being recognized on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Never happens. How all of that country was tuned in to watch the Olympic gold medal game. Never happens. and you hope you get your bump, right? And I think, you know, obviously Dreisaitl and Stutzel, they predate that bump. They're well down the path before that game happens. But you're hoping now, okay, can we have more of them? Are there more Dreisaitls? Are there more Stutzels? Is this going to become normal? And you hope so, because the sport needs growth. So when you talk about Germany, I think about our conversation about Slovakia and how this is exactly what we need.
You know, one of the what I thought was going to be a throwaway question turned into something that was pretty funny. I asked him about his blade. I remember you doing a feature on Hockey Night with Pavel Datsyuk.
Yeah.
And you had one of his sticks and you were talking about like this canoe paddle that he has for a blade. And Dreisaitl is the same way. You know, his dad had one, he said, Peter, who's sort of hockey royalty in Germany, part of the German Hockey Hall of Fame, great player, has gone on to coach. And he talked about how he's always just played with a long blade. And he finds it weird when he looks at other players on the Edmonton Oilers who at the end of practice sometimes want to grab his stick and try to use it because the blade is just enormous. And this, he said the term that he has for the blade, you'd love this. This is like, this thing is like thought 31 for Elliot Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
You know what he calls his blade on his hockey stick, which is so long, which is kind of like Pavel Datsyuk as well.
What does he call it?
I call it the burger flipper. My dad, when he played, he used a very similar curve. And since obviously I'm a young kid, I've been using it, and I made it a little longer because I liked, you know, my backhand on it. And there's just so many things that I, in my opinion, think are very effective, having a long blade and, you know, being able to control the puck. So, yeah, it's I know it looks weird and awkward at times, but I love it. I've always loved it, and I don't think I'll be changing it anytime soon.
He calls it the burger flipper.
I'm going to have to write that down.
That is thought 31 for Elliot Friedman.
No, that'll be higher.
The burger flipper. It's available online. Go have a listen to it. Dreisaitl talks about a lot of different things.
He's a good interview, eh?
We mentioned this.
He's excellent.
First time I met him was at Memorial Cup in Quebec City when he was playing for Kelowna. And during the interview with him the other day, I mentioned, you know, I want to get his thoughts on Anthony Cirelli because he played against Oshawa in that Memorial Cup final. Cirelli had both goals for the Generals, including the overtime winner, last goal ever scored at the Colisée. And he kind of gave me one of those, yeah, you had to bring that up, didn't you? But I remember talking to Dreisaitl for the first time then, and he seemed shy but confident. Like, he was a really interesting guy. Shy but confident was the one thing that I took away from meeting Leon Dreisaitl. Because I think the first thing that I asked him was, can we have one of your sticks to use on set? Because Todd Warner wanted to talk about the blade.
Did you sell it after? You probably did.
No, we gave it back.
Oh, that doesn't sound like you.
Yeah, I know. Unlike Ryan O'Reilly's that I did that with on a Scotiabank Wednesday night hockey show when I was doing ringside at a Buffalo game. I said, do you mind if we use your stick? He's like, yeah, just go pick one out and keep it. So I still have it to this day with that crazy toe curve.
That's nice.
Yeah, O'Reilly's a great guy. All right, here's one of the latest pieces of news. And that's the San Jose Sharks making it official. The bench looks like Bob Bugner, head coach, Rocky Thompson, and John Madden. From AHL Cleveland. The San Jose Sharks making it official with their bench. Elliot Friedman says what?
I think San Jose debated some other candidates. I think they considered the possibility of going exterior. It's kind of the same thing that Calgary did. You've got a guy who knows your team, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go out and replace him, you're going to be spending more money. And again, like, people always say, oh, that means you think they're going cheap. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is, do you really believe that the person you're going out to spend a ton more money for is going to be able to handle your team better than the guy you've already got there?
Right.
And I just think at the end of the day, San Jose said no. And I think the one thing that's really interesting with San Jose is that there was a lot of talk from the players at the end of last year. Martin Jones has said it. Logan Couture has said it. That the way they handled things last year was not acceptable. And Bugner would have seen it. he knows exactly what those guys are talking about. The Sharks, it doesn't sound like, were a true team last year. They were a fractured group. They didn't get along. And you've got a guy here who knows exactly what the problems were and has had time to say, this is how we're going to handle it, because I know it, I saw it, and this is how we're going to make it better. And so I think that's what it is. I mean, you know Rocky Thompson.
Yes.
San Jose got a guy there who I think was in demand. I think Toronto had interest in him before they went to Manny Malhotra. I think he was a guy that Sheldon Keefe really wouldn't have minded to have on their bench. So I think that's one situation. I think there were others. That's a good hire for them. And I just think that they go with a guy who saw firsthand what their issues were and had the advantage of that knowledge and time to prepare how he was going to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. What does San Jose do here in the offseason? And we don't know how long this offseason is going to be when it's finally upon us. Is it going to be quick? Is it going to be, or are we in for a marathon wait here? We don't know. But what do you see Doug Wilson doing here?
Well, he's looked at another goalie for Jones. Last year, their backup was Aaron Dell. They kicked the tires on Jake Allen. And Doug Wilson, he kicks tires on a lot of things. I know they've asked about Kemper. I don't think they have the assets to pull off a Kemper deal necessarily. But I think one of the other things they've kind of looked at is there like a guy out there, like say someone, and this is just off the top of my head, a guy like Thomas Greiss. Who San Jose knows, who goes and shares the job with Martin Jones. So I think that's number one. I think they're looking at shoring up that position. But I think the other thing too is it just didn't fit right for Carlson most of last year. You've got to make sure that that fit works. And you're sitting there and you've got two power play demons in him and Burns, and you're trying to figure out how to make it work. Like, that's the thing I think you have to do. When you have guys who are your top players and they're among your top paid players, you've got to make sure that you find a way to make it work so it benefits your team. And that's the way I kind of look at it. How do we make this fit? Because if it doesn't fit, it's going to be a problem. But, just from the way the players have talked, they weren't a team last year. And some of it was, Pavelski's not there, and all of a sudden you have this loss of a presence in your room. Well, I don't think you can use that as an excuse anymore after the season. You have to move on. You have to say, okay, we let this bother us last year. How are you going to fix it so it doesn't happen again this year? I don't think there's any chance that they thought that DeBoer was going to be out last season. It happened because that group couldn't pull it together. I think that's one thing they have to fix. The other thing, too, is guys told me the Sharks, they could really check. They didn't check last year. It was a lot easier to play against them than it has been in the past.
I remember talking to Kevin Bieksa, I think it was might have been last year or the year before, about teams in the West. And I said, which is the most difficult team to read on the breakout? And he said, San Jose. He said, there's no team in the West that has more different ways to break out than the San Jose Sharks. I thought that was a real interesting comment. And as much as we may focus on the future of Joe Thornton and is he going back to the San Jose Sharks, and I'm going to ask you that one here in a second, the contract negotiation that I might be most interested in with San Jose, Elliot, is Kevin LeBanc. Now, Kevin LeBanc came in last year on a one-year deal at $1 million. And we all looked at that and said, okay.
What's the next deal?
That's Kevin LeBanc and his camp doing Doug Wilson a solid because they're in tough with the salary cap. And listen, we saw this with, Marcus Pettersson with the Pittsburgh Penguins and something similar as well. Okay, so what's the next deal going to look like knowing that LeBanc did him a solid the season before? But after a 14-goal campaign, if you're Doug Wilson, how do you handle this one? Like, this one's tricky. That camp did you a solid the year before. Didn't exactly light it up. It was a challenging year for everybody, Kevin LeBanc included. What do you do now? This to me is one of the more interesting and tough situations that any general manager is in. How do you do it?
Let's just say there was a deal done there. Do you ever go back on your word? What circumstances would make you say...
Well, the circumstance right now, the circumstance with flat cap and unknown future, all of that, the world has changed, so we need to change along with it. And what I said last year doesn't apply. It's a tough one. It's a tough one to go back on.
Let's just say, because, you know, we're having, you know, a conversation that there's a lot of hypotheticals here, but that's what we do. We're in sports podcasting. We have hypothetical conversations. I look at it this way. If you're going to do that, Jeff, you have to have a legitimate alternative that's going to make that player happy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe what you do is you say, look, do you want to go short term? Or say the cap, you thought the cap was going up to 85. Do you decrease it by 4 million out of 81? What is that? 5%?
Mm-hmm.
Say, okay, we'll give you the contract, but we decrease the value by 5%. You know, is that what you do? You better have an alternative. You better have a reason. I will tell you, I believe there's one contract in the NHL right now, a big one. And the only reason I'm not going to say the name is because the people close to it have said it's not true, but I think they're lying to me. I just can't prove it. I believe there's one contract in the NHL that was agreed to in advance, and they made a commitment to doing it. Now the team regrets it.
And they've got to go back on their word, or they're planning on going back on the...
No, they did it. They did it. You know, they said, you know, we gave our word. And it might turn out to be okay, but a little bit of the initial return, they were starting to sweat it. I think they discussed internally, do we go back on it? I'm not sure we can do this. But at the end of the day, they said, you know, we made a promise. We're going to do it. I think there's a chance it could still turn out okay, but the early returns haven't been great. And, you know, I heard when this player was having a rough time and the contract looked like a real mess, I called the team and I said, did this happen? And they said, no. And I guess the team told the agent and the agent called me and said that definitely did not happen. But I think they're kind of fibbing to me a bit. I mean, some people can be really ruthless. It comes down to your personality.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ruthless or not? And what does your handshake mean to you? What does your word mean to you? And some people say, look, you didn't keep up your end of the bargain. So I'm not, because your play wasn't good enough, I can't do that now. It can go a lot of different directions, right? Like, Jeff, how would you feel if you had a handshake deal with someone and they said, Jeff, you know, you weren't that good this year. It's off the table.
Feel like anybody else would. Anybody else listening to this podcast, we had a deal. I did you a solid. I did you a favor. You were in a tough spot. I didn't kill you on it. I did you a favor. Now, it's the back end of that deal.
This is why I'm never doing house renovations again, because that always seems to happen with renovations.
Ultimately, it comes down to a question that I love asking general managers, which is, would you lie if it would help your team?
I think they would.
Yes, of course they would. I think everybody would.
Depends on, you know, what we're talking about here, right?
Well, if even, you know, it looks at, it sort of winks at the even bigger question here is it possible to do that job for a long, like as long as some of these gentlemen, and we're talking about Doug Wilson, who's been with San Jose a long time. Like, is it possible to do that job without lying? Because I'm of the firm belief that you're there for a long time in the NHL. You have like a 20, 30 year career as a manager. I would say it's like almost impossible to get out clean.
I agree with that. Like, you know, guys lie to us all the time and they're unapologetic about it. They say, look, we have to. We can't have all this stuff out there.
one of the great stories that I think I've told us on the podcast before, speaking of which, when Bill Waters was an assistant general manager with the Maple Leafs, he told me, he's like, he invited Mike Zeisberger over to his place, who was writing for the Sun at that point. And Zeisberger had all the details on the Matt Sundin contract, called Bill for confirmation. Bill denied all of it. And as he's walking Zeisberger through the house a year after the Sundin deal happened with the Maple Leafs, Bill says to Zeisberger, "And Mike, that over there in the corner was a chair I was sitting on when I lied to you about the Matt Sundin contract," which I always thought was pretty honest and pretty hilarious by Bill Waters there.
Bob Arum, the boxing promoter. "Yesterday I was lying, today I'm telling the truth."
Ottawa Senators. Pierre Dorion saying there's no deal for Craig Anderson, but saying he's the best goalie we ever had.
But we've let Craig know that we will not be offering him a contract. Craig, you know, Craig should be given so much credit. It was one of the best trades Brian Murray made. He's the winningest goalie in this organization. I'll go on the record and say he's the most performing goalie in this organization, the best goalie we've ever had. But it's now it's time for us to take another direction. And we thank him for everything he did. When we made that conference run finals, a few years ago, everyone knows that Craig was probably our MVP, and you know, unfortunately, that Kunitz goal. But you know, it's unfortunate that we were never able to win a cup with Craig. But Craig did many wonderful things for this organization.
So Craig Anderson will not return, and we all know that Mark Borowiecki will not return either. What's happening with Ottawa?
If you go back a couple years, Eugene Melnyk had said that these next couple years were going to be lower payroll years, mm-hmm. right? He said the idea was they wouldn't spend much last year and they wouldn't spend as much this year, and then they'd start to pay. And they also said they're going to take care of their young guys, right? Well, they took care of Shabbat.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's got an issue with that. They took care of Colin White. And, you know, last year was a rough year, but I don't think that's over. They're trying to take care of Brady Tkachuk. I have a sneaking suspicion they want to take care of Connor Brown. And they're just looking at this and saying, look, like that's where the money's going. And the thing about Borowiecki is it looks like Borowiecki feels like we're talking about like handshakes or, you know, promises. It looks like Borowiecki thinks that a promise was broken to him.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know. I'm not in that room. But it's clear he thinks that there was something.
See, Ottawa's going to be one of the more interesting teams here in the next couple of weeks leading up to the draft. They have the two picks. Mm-hmm. The first one is going to be essentially whomever LA doesn't take at number two, either Quentin Byfield or Tim Stützle. So take your pick. One of them's going to fall to Pierre Dorion. And then five's going to be interesting.
Yep.
And I'm told there's three different beliefs in that organization. Ascribe whomever to whomever you feel fit. That there is the let's take a defenseman here, and there is a belief that that would be Jake Sanderson, Jeff Sanderson's kid. There is another belief within the organization that they are thin on the right side as it comes to prospects after players like Drake Batherson. And that Jack Quinn, who's a 50-goal scorer, two-way player with the Ottawa 67s, the local boy, might be the right fit for Ottawa, which would mean you would be taking two forwards. But maybe there's a belief that next season there's a lot of defensemen in that area. Ottawa expects to be back in that scenario at the draft, and you get a defenseman then. And then the wild card in all of it is the goaltender. And he just had an outstanding week in the KHL, as we all know, and that's his Yaroslav Askarov. And there's some belief that there are people in the organization that think they might look at taking the goalie that high. To me, this draft is so interesting at number five. We all know who number one is going to be. Two and three is kind of interesting, but there's only two candidates. Detroit at four, probably going to go for one of the defensemen, maybe Jamie Drysdale. Or maybe Cole Perfetti, the forward from Saginaw. But five is fascinating. Like, honestly, Elliot, I can't wait to get to five at the draft. That's going to be one, maybe the most interesting pick. And I think leading up to it, Ottawa is going to be one of the more interesting teams to follow here.
Now, I'll tell you this, Askarov.
Yep.
If Ottawa doesn't take him there, you know who I wonder about?
Carolina? Seems to be the obvious one.
No, there's someone before them.
Minnesota at 9.
Before them.
Let's see. New Jersey's got Mackenzie Blackwood. Buffalo's got Lokanen.
I still think it could be New Jersey.
You don't think they have it in Mackenzie Blackwood?
You got to have more than one, right? I could see New Jersey weighing it there and really battling over, do we take a skater? Do we take the goalie?
That high. Woof. We're getting to Carey Price territory here.
Someone's going to do it. Blackwood looks really good. No question about it. And New Jersey needs defensemen too.
Yes.
New Jersey's got what? 3 first rounders?
Yes. 7, 18, and 20.
Like, there's some talk that they may move another one for a player, one of the later ones, which makes a lot of sense. You know, they need some help right away. And if they want to do it, they'll certainly be able to do it. And maybe that's what they'll do later on. But with that pick, you know, a few teams have said to me, they're really curious. They could see New Jersey doing that player, Askarov, even though they've got Blackwood, because they don't have any depth, really. Mm-hmm. And what it gives you is at least the asset. Now, all of a sudden, you have 2 young guys you're really hopeful in, and in a 2-goalie league, and also where you could say, well, if at the very least, if we can't keep both, we can do something with one that can get us some help somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that from an asset management point of view. Like, I totally get that. I know last year, you know, people shook their heads at Florida taking Spencer Knight and then giving Bobrovsky a 7-year deal. I don't think this is the same situation. This is 2 young guys, and you can kind of see how it plays out. You're not necessarily locked in with either one of them long term. But I know there's a couple teams wondering if New Jersey will be that team. And then move another number one later.
Then that makes things even more interesting for Ottawa. If there's not enough pressure right now to take the goaltender at 5, if there's speculation that New Jersey's going to grab him at that spot.
I don't think they're the only ones. I think Buffalo's not crazy about its goaltending. They have a great prospect there.
Lokanen, Jukka-Pekka Lokanen's coming.
But I think organizationally, like, I think they're looking at goaltending actually more at the NHL level, I would say. You mentioned Minnesota. What does Nashville think at 11?
Yeah, Nashville's another one. Although I would think that they'd be looking forwards. They'd be looking for goal scoring.
What about Edmonton 14?
Edmonton's another one.
And you mentioned Carolina.
I don't think there's any chance he gets past 13.
So there you go.
Watch the goalie. Line of the week, the quote of the week. I didn't come to Arizona to get a tan. First week on the job for new GM, Bill Armstrong.
Yeah.
What is he looking at?
Well, I think, first of all, I think there's a chance that Ryan Jankowski runs his draft.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that Brian Decord from the Maple Leafs, who's Joey Decord's father, could end up in their organization too.
Okay.
I'll tell you this, they have a good goalie coach there, Corey Schwab. He's got a good rep. So I wonder how that would all work. But Decord, I believe they have the ability to talk to him. He works in Toronto now. I've heard Jeff Crisp's name in there as part of the staff. And the other name I heard there was, I've got it right here, Corey Banica. But although, like, Corey Banica and Jeff Crisp, they were in Buffalo with Jankowski. Like, I think those are all names as he's putting his staff there. You know, and then I think it depends on what he does with his players, which goalie goes. I said, by the way, that Montreal considered Dubnyk. Someone told me that it was 3 goalies Montreal was looking at: Allen, Dubnyk, and Raanta.
Hmm.
So I think one of the goalies is going. And I also believe that, you know, I mean, what's going to happen with OEL? What's going to happen with the head coach? They're going to make some changes there. There's no question about it. I think they're going to reset. You know, Derek Stepan's a guy whose bonus has been paid, so his actual cash is lower. Teams are always looking for centers.
And as we mentioned before, specifically right shot centers.
Yes. Now, we should credit Craig Morgan, too, who he reported that Hjalmarsson's not waving. I think that's a family reason because of his family situation. He wants to stay in Arizona.
Yep.
So he's not going anywhere. But I think other players, I still think OEL's got some interest out there. And, you know, I'm curious to see how this is all going to work.
Any more thoughts on what's happening with Alex Pietrangelo? It almost seems like it's the daily watch now.
Everyone's playing hardball here. Like, this is an intense, intense game of poker. Like, sometimes when things go public and Pietrangelo went public, it affects people. St. Louis, for now, is only drawing a harder line. I believe the offer is 8x8. Maybe there's some room there for movement, but I think that's generally where they are. Alex Pietrangelo wants the no-move clause. And he wants bonuses late in his deal. He wants his deal to be buyout proof. Like, for example, Drew Doughty's contract is not buyout proof.
And he negotiated that by himself, by the way. Should point that out.
Yes, he did. And if you look at it, all of Drew Doughty's signing bonuses, he's got $20 million in bonuses. And they're all in the first 4 years of his deal. The last 4 years of his deal is all base salary. It's $44 million over 4 years, $11 million in cash. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, if you're the Kings, you know, you're hoping that he's still worth that and you're not even thinking about buying it out. You know, if worst comes to worst, they can do it. Pietrangelo doesn't want that structure. He wants bonuses late, so the Blues don't buy him out. The Blues don't do bonuses. Tarasenko, no bonuses. By the way, Jonas Brodin, who just had his deal done, no bonuses. Edmondson got some bonuses, but Brodin none. The Blues don't do bonuses. They're saying no. But I got to tell you, like this one, Doug Armstrong, by this going public, he's not going to back down. This will entrench him even more. The agents for Pietrangelo at Newport, they're used to battling these things in public. They're not going to be afraid of it. Everybody here is kind of comfortable in this arena. Now, I think they're going to take another run at this. The releasing of the story was strategic with a few weeks left in free agency to see if pressure would get ratcheted up. I think they take another run at this, but it's gotten really personal. It's clear that Pietrangelo is upset at the way he's been treated here. He feels he's been disrespected. He feels there hasn't been enough negotiating. Like, never mind the fact that they're not in a place where they're agreeing right now. There's never been a lot of negotiating. It was idle for a long time, and I think that really bothered him. I don't think, like, he's jealous of guys like Shen or Falk got his deal done right away, and Scandella got a deal done pretty quickly. Shen got a deal done, and all of these were market value deals or above. I don't think he's jealous of that, but I think he is saying, hey, like, what about me? And he feels he's not getting a market value deal, and he's upset about it. So I think the emotion has really gotten into all of this, and now the emotion is more, no, I'm not budging on every side. And I think there's a limit to what St. Louis will do, and they're saying we're not going to make an exception for you. And I think there's teams here like Vegas, like Toronto. Florida to me would be really interesting, because I think Florida has kind of looked at it like, we've done a lot of this. We've thrown money at people, and we have to start spending. We have to start developing our own guys. But I think Pietrangelo is too hard not to look at. And he does change your identity. And we talked about Florida wanting to change its identity. Mm-hmm. But I think all these teams are sitting here saying, okay, A, is this real? Is this going to happen? And I think there's a chance. And B, if we do this, how are we going to make it work? Like, I do think he wants to go to Vegas if he makes it. I think they're probably the team. My guess is they're the team at the top of his list. And I think Vegas would do it. That's kind of the way they're wired. But they're going to have to do some other things to do it.
See, isn't this a situation where a team like, and you mentioned Vegas, but a team like the Maple Leafs would have an advantage over other squads? Because I can see a lot of teams right now balking at the idea of bonuses. No thanks, we're not interested in that structure of contract. But as we've talked about before, is that not an area where a team like Toronto, where Dubas can walk in and go, bonuses? Yeah, we pay all of our guys on July 1st.
But I'm not even convinced, though, that Toronto's that crazy about that right now. Like, Montreal gave bonuses to Edmondson. They weren't ridiculous. You look at the structure of Edmondson's new deal. He got no signing bonus this year. And of his $14 million deal, he's getting $5 million in bonuses. One next year and two each the years after. That's not a ton. But I don't know if Toronto's going to be, I know everybody thinks that Toronto's this endless money pit, and to some degree they kind of are, but I'm not sure they're even that crazy about doing this now. Now, if Petrangelo says to them, I'm willing to take my bonuses later because I'm hoping the escrow will go down, I do think that could appeal to teams. But I don't think even teams like Toronto are going to be as bonus crazy as they were in the past. Like, I think right now, I can't see them. I mean, Petrangelo might be the difference because he could be the difference for you. But I don't think they're eager to do those Tavares, Matthews, Marner structured contracts right now.
I don't know, man. If you're the Maple Leafs and you feel you are this close to a Stanley Cup and that might be the final piece.
Oh, boy. So do you think they're that close to a Stanley Cup?
I think they think that they're close to a Stanley Cup. I think that you look at that talent up front, and we'll see what Dubas does with the back end, but Alex Petrangelo and the net mining, what Alex Petrangelo makes that a whole lot tastier.
Does Alex Petrangelo make the Leafs a Stanley Cup contender? I think there's a lot of growth that still has to come in that roster. I'll tell you this. I think he makes them a lot better. I think he's exactly what they need. But I still think there's growing to do in that roster.
Well, it's not as if you're getting Petrangelo for one season, though.
I understand that.
That's it. Like when those, whatever, however long it takes for that growing to happen, and I don't think anyone's thinking like 3 or 4 years here, Alex Petrangelo is still with you if you do the deal with him now.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think he gives you a chance to be in that conversation, but I still think there has to be growth in your roster. That's the way I would say it. Now, the other thing I wanted to say is, like, you know, every week, like, it's like, okay, watch this team. And it's been like...
Started with Colorado, yeah. And then it's Arizona's getting rid of everybody. And who is it
well,
now?
Well, no, but I think a team ready to that might be looking to strike big. Mm-hmm. You know who I think that team could be?
Looking to strike big. Shoot.
Columbus.
What are they looking for? Goal scoring?
I think they want to score.
Listen, they tried for Mitch Marner last offseason. I don't think that desire to get a scorer has gone away.
No. I don't see a match, but I could see them being in on Laine. I just don't see the match.
You could see them making a move to trade for Patrick Laine in Winnipeg?
I think Winnipeg's looking at this and saying, are we going to have to do this? And I could see Columbus being really interested in that. I just don't know if they have what Winnipeg needs. Like, you're not trading Seth Jones and you're not trading Werenski. So is there a match there? I don't know. They're looking at moving one of the goalies. I think they're going to try.
All right. Then as we're just spitballing here, considering how they made the play for Mitch Marner once upon a time, snuggle up on this grassy knoll.
What are you going to say, Barzal?
Offer sheet, Matthew Barzal.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I got to tell you, like, you know where the offer sheets I hear right now? Tampa.
Oh, for Cirelli and Sergachev.
People say to me, Tampa's offer sheet vulnerable. I mean, yeah, but are we really going to see one? I just don't know, Jeff, at this time where we're talking about the teams don't have cash and are we going to see signing bonuses and stuff like that? Is someone actually going to do an offer sheet under those circumstances? I just don't know. In the time of COVID, are we really going to see offer sheets? I don't know if I believe it.
They're going to have to make significant dumping moves, though.
Yeah, and people are waiting. People are waiting to see, you know, what Tampa's going to do, because there's going to potentially be good players available. It reminds me of Chicago.
Yeah.
Chicago won the cup in 10 and they had to make moves. Like, we don't know if Tampa's going to win the cup, but they're going to have to make moves. But I'll tell you this, going back, I look at Columbus and I think there's some teams who believe that they're trying to do something, make some news, rattle the cages a bit.
Interesting. All right. We'll step away briefly. Lots of good stuff there. We'll come back and talk to Kyle Wellwood, a former NHLer, talking about his career and concussion reporting as well. Stay tuned. Elliot, very much looking forward to this conversation with Kyle Wellwood. Lots to get to with the former NHLer, and we are going to end up talking about head check health and concussion reporting. Kyle Wellwood, thanks so much for stopping by today. Give us a quick snapshot. What are you doing now? We don't spend enough time on this podcast, you know, catching up with ex-NHLers and getting a snapshot of their lives. What are you doing now, Kyle?
Well, I think like a lot of alumni, I'm taking care of kids because I was gone playing hockey. So that's probably my number one thing, is supporting, you know, my wife and the kids and being a dad. And then on the side, I'm a board member of Head Check Health. We do concussion management. We write software and make it easier for everyone to follow concussion protocols.
Now, are you the tough parent or are you the parent who says, play with matches? What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, I think I'm the tough parent and also the one that says to play with matches. And I think my wife has to catch us doing the bad things. Otherwise, you know, they're going to get hurt. So I definitely would let them do some dangerous things. But I would also say I'm tough.
Okay.
There's a term that I sort of use privately for players like you, Kyle, and I call them superhero hockey players, in that if you look at them in everyday life, you don't assume for a second that they play in the NHL, and then they put the equipment on and all of a sudden they're one of the most dynamic players on the ice. That's kind of how I always looked at you. How did you feel playing hockey? Did you feel like you fit in with everybody else?
I think I did fit in pretty well when I started out, but as my career went longer, I felt less and less like fitting in with the hockey crowd. I think the game just changed substantially from, you know, when I came in the league, we had, you know, Ed Belfour, Trevor Kidd, Nat, we had, you know, Brian Marchment, Aki Berg, you know, a bunch of guys on the back, Caberle, you know, it was just sort of, you know, hockey players, right? And later on, it was everybody just went home and watched Netflix or wanted a nutrition plan, and they wanted to just keep working out and doing those things. So
it
was interesting how much the league switched from, you know, just go out there and play to let's focus on the external activities and make sure we're doing them well.
Do you blame Gary Roberts for that?
Yeah, you know, I think Gary was the first one to switch. It seemed like he was sort of the fun guy and then switched to, okay, I'm going to be the fun guy, but I want to keep playing the NHL, so I'm going to be the hardest working fitness guy. Yeah.
I've always wondered, Kyle, if you could go back and do it over again, would you change anything about the way you approached it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. But I did have a great time.
Yeah.
It was difficult for me to say I was going to put more work in and not have as good of a time. I don't think that would be very genuine for me to say.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my injuries when I was younger, I should have handled them better. I think I had three surgeries in a row, three groin surgeries in a row with the Leafs when I was younger. And, you know, I think if I handled when I got hurt the first time, if I didn't push myself so hard, I wouldn't have had to have all those surgeries. So, yeah, I think I would have done it differently.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I told someone we were going to be talking to you, one of your former teammates, and it was interesting what he said. He said that Kyle Wellwood was a guy who always seemed to have a lot of fun. Like, he was a guy who was incredibly skilled, really talented, smile on his face, loved to have a good time. But he did mention that because of some of the injuries that happened early in your career and the way either they were handled or you felt they were handled, it kind of changed you a little bit. And he kind of wondered if that ever really, that affected your joy for it and your love for it. And, you know, you're very involved in concussion health now. It's obviously something that's very important, not only to you, but to a lot of people. And he wonders if that's kind of goes back to, boy, I bet you Kyle wishes there was a different path with some of the things he faced at the beginning of his career.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think if you look at now how they'll handle young players who are hurt and trying to play through it, it's much different, and they take a really proactive approach to thinking about the long term. Where, you know, I was playing and I was I think at one point after my surgery I was playing three or four weeks later, and I was only playing the games, and I would skip every practice, and that's at, you know, 21, 22 years old, just to try to make the playoffs. So, you know, there's some things that you look back and say, oh wow, why did they handle it that way, right? But that's the way it was. And, you know, I certainly had a good time. And yeah, does it affect you when you're older? Yeah, I think so. Because when you have injuries, you never fully get back to where you played the first time, mm-hmm. in a lot of cases. So, I mean, you're playing hockey, but you're not really reaching your potentials that you used to have. So I think that's really hard to play through as well.
I'm curious about your relationship with a couple of your different coaches, specifically in Toronto, Pat Quinn and Paul Maurice. And we'll get to Paul here in a couple of seconds. But one of my memories of your relationship with Pat was when you did the in-between the legs move. And I don't think Pat was very impressed. do you have a memory on that? And what was your relationship with Quinn like?
You know, I was so young. I was a rookie on the team. I was like so excited to be there. And I was on a very veteran laden team. So, you know, I just came every day and tried to work to stay in the lineup. And, but Pat was very good to me. I think he may say some things, but he was a player's coach and he just let everybody play. So I can't recall one time where he approached me during practice or the games and said, go do this better, or you get in the corner, or, you know, you stand here, do that. He really just rolled the bench really well. And, you know, if you didn't have a good shift, or you didn't, you know, get the puck out or do what he wanted, you could just sit the bench. You know, it wasn't sort of, don't go try things. So he was very good that way.
What about Paul? What was your relationship like with Paul Maurice?
It was great. Actually, his wife's mom taught me in grade school, believe it or not. So
that'd be Windsor, right?
In Windsor, right? So, she taught me in grade four, I think. So there was a connection there already. And, you know, he gave me lots of opportunity. He had me on the first line with Mats and playing on the first power play. So he gave me a lot of opportunity. It's unfortunate that I got hurt. And I don't think there was as much communication with the staff, the coach, the management when somebody was hurt. You just always just try to keep playing no matter what. And, you know, I just started digressing through my injuries. And, you know, I think our relationship got challenged that way.
Did you ever say to Paul Maurice, your mother-in-law is a much better teacher than you ever were?
that would have been a good thing to say, but I think he already would have jumped to the gun and started saying that first. So I couldn't use it against him.
Now, Kevin BX is a guy who liked Vigneault. Were you a Vigneault guy too? Did you like him?
I wasn't a Vigneault guy. I really liked his coaching, and I think we could have had a good relationship. But when I got to Vancouver, I was, I had the three surgeries, and then I broke my leg in the summer training.
Yep.
So I went there early, and I worked with the training staff and did the best I could to get ready for the season. And, you know, I was still, because I hadn't skated much, I was still, you know, laboring out there in training camp still. And I think he noticed it. And, you know, they had a very fitness heavy team. Like, a lot of guys were in great shape.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Vigneault didn't want me on the team. So, you know, he went out in the media and said, I'm not good enough shape to play in the NHL. And then they let me go. So obviously I'm not a fan of Vigneault's for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on my way to Russia and two guys got hurt in the same game. It was Dmytro and Kessler got hurt in the same game. So they had to call me up on waivers to play center. And I ended up staying for 2 years under Vigneault. So we got off to a really rocky start, I'd say. And, you know, I wasn't happy to be there with him for the 2 years. That's for sure.
You know, would you ever say anything, Kyle? Because you're, I mean, you're quiet, but you're blunt. Like, you're a quietly confident guy. And I would you ever go to Vigneault and say, I didn't like that. I didn't think that was right.
No, I wouldn't say that. I think it was so out there for somebody to say that. I think that the guys were surprised, and because we had a few new guys on our team too. And when I came back, it was sort of awkward at first. Like, okay, are you on the team now after all that? Like, you said you couldn't play. You know, I think it was so blatant that it was such a weird circumstance that I even got back on the team. So, you know, I don't think I had to say much. I think you knew where the relationship was going to stand at that point.
I remember Kelly Rudy telling me once, we were talking about retirement, and Kelly Rudy made the point to me, the minute you think about retirement, part of you retires. Like, the minute that enters your head, part of you checks out. At what point, Kyle, in your career, did you start to think about not playing anymore?
I think it was on the Leafs. I think when I was going through my injuries, I was thinking that. And I remember talking to my agent, and, you know, I asked, went in and asked the team for the trade. And I, you know, because it's not fun to be injured and then...
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can tell in practice you're not very good, and then having to go and play for the Toronto Maple Leafs on TV, you know, it's not like, oh, this is going to be good, right? So you just want to go play anywhere and rehab and do something else other than that. So, I mean, it was a tough time for sure. But, I mean, there's nothing else you can do. That's just what can happen sometimes in sports.
You know, you are an incredibly skilled guy. You know, your talent level was off the charts. And I was wondering if you ever did anything in practice or in a game, Kyle, that your teammates looked at you and said, holy smokes, like, how did you pull that off?
Well, I think so. I think just because I played with it sort of a shorter stick and I used my feet a lot. And I think when I was younger, not a lot of players were doing the things they do now, where, you know, they're using their feet constantly to pick up passes, and they're, you know, using different angles to get the puck into the net. So, you know, I think it was just a different time. I think the game was a little less shooting, a little more playing in tight quarters. So I had to find a way to get the puck to the net, and I had to use my feet and spins and different things, right? And I'd have to make a lot of plays where I was falling. So... because I'd be getting pushed around, but I still have to get the puck where I needed to, right? So, yeah, so it's just a different time. But no, I can't recall anything specific.
I remember when you were drafted by the Maple Leafs, and someone I talked to in the organization, when I asked about you, because I watched you play plenty in junior, and this one person made the point to me, because I was asking, like, okay, what do you guys see in Wellwood? Why bring him into the organization? And this person said to me, well, he's played in Belleville and Windsor. You're traded for Jason Spezza to go to Windsor. And this person said to me, he led the OHL in scoring in Belleville, which had the international ice surface, as we all know from that time. And then he gets traded to Windsor, which is the smallest rink in the OHL. And this person said to me, if you lead the league on the biggest ice and the smallest ice, there's something there. At what point did you, Kyle, realize that there was something there with you that was going to lead you to the NHL one day?
I don't really know. It wasn't as popular as it was. You know, I always wanted to play in the NHL, but like the path to get there wasn't as structured.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I remember getting the phone call that I was drafted to Belleville, and I'm from Windsor, Ontario, and we never really went out east on the 401 past Toronto. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were always in Michigan. So it was like, where's Belleville? Like, we had no idea, right?
Hmm.
And I hardly even knew the OHL draft was going to go on. So it wasn't the same. And even I remember before the year I'd led the league in scoring, I didn't skate once. So I went into the season right from summer to training camp and 2-day training camp, and I ended up having a really good season. So it wasn't as structured. It wasn't like, oh, the fitness trainer said to do this in the summer and I worked hard. It was just playing, right? So it was a totally different atmosphere than it is now. It's hard to even imagine not having like the full workout rooms in the OHL locker rooms and things like that, because we just didn't have that, right? Nobody was on the bikes. There's only a couple guys that, you know, went to a gym on the side. So
let me ask you about one more junior question. How Elliot's rolling his eyes. Oh, here it comes, Merrick, with the junior
not
questions.
Not too bad. But, not too bad.
Okay, so there's one. Here's the second one. I promise I'll get off the junior page. But one of the events where people really started to get to know you was Halifax 2003 at the World Junior Championships. And it's Alex Ovechkin and the Washington Capitals beat Team Canada 3-2 in the final. Carlo Koliakovo was fantastic in that tournament. Remember Tuomo Ruutu? Was really good in that. Upshaw was great for Canada. What were some of your, Igor Grigorenko, who unfortunately never worked out for the Red Wings after the car crash, was fantastic in that tournament. What are your memories from Halifax 2003?
It was just a wonderful time to be, you know, a young kid, because it's sort of your first taste of being with, you know, I guess the people who get chosen to play on the team is very important. And it feels like you sort of made it somewhere for the first time.
Right.
Because, you know, like, oh, geez, I actually probably do have a shot at the NHL because I made this team. And you look at how many people that played in the team playing the NHL. So I think it's the first time you think like, oh, okay, I can make the NHL. And then in Halifax, the fans were unbelievable. So we had in the locker room, they were just, you know, smashing the pavement and the chairs, and you could hear them before you came out. And it was just a lot of fun. It was nerve wracking. I think everybody played super nervous. And yeah, that Russian team. Yeah. I do remember their captain, Grigorenko.
Grigorenko, yeah.
More than Ovechkin. He was definitely their, you know, all around star player. So yeah. And he ended up winning it for them. I think he got at least one goal. So it was great for sure.
That was a heck of a tournament.
Yeah, it was. I got to tell you, Kyle, I hate people like you who did things on pure talent and no work. I just want to tell you that. Some of us have to work really hard to be successful, so we really hate people like that. I wanted to ask you about 2011. It was a really interesting scenario. You're in the KHL, and you get an offer from the NHL. The St. Louis Blues want to sign you, and they do. But because you're in the KHL, they have to put you on waivers, and San Jose claims you. What was that whole process like? Because I remember the Blues were furious at the Sharks.
Mm.
It was really odd because I was in Russia, and we switched coaches 3 times in the first 2 weeks. And then I just stopped playing. Like, I had to go in the game, and this is true. You were allowed to dress an extra player, like 13 guys at forward. And I just sat the bench. I literally played like 30 seconds or less the whole game. So for like 2 months, I would just get dressed for the game and sit on the bench and travel all around Russia. So it was like so boring, but there was no spots open in the NHL, of course, at that time, right? So we waited until January before, you know, all those deadlines are, and, you know, there's always a lot of injuries, and they could always use, you know, a face-off guy or somebody on the power play to help out. So when I came back after a summer of nobody calling, I got a couple calls and signed with St. Louis, and the waiver rule was anybody below them, and San Jose happened to not be having a very good season, despite all the talent. Then me and my wife, we drove to St. Louis because we thought anywhere from St. Louis, we can just drive our vehicle if I get picked up on waivers and we'll get there. And then sure enough, the one place you sort of couldn't was California, Southern California. So, you know, she had to drive back to Windsor alone. And then I took a flight to San Jose. But yeah, we were excited. I mean, San Jose, everybody wants to play there.
Yeah, and, you know, the other thing I want to ask you, Kyle, is Eric. We've talked about good coaches. Is your brother a future NHL coach? And if so, will you be on his staff?
I will not be on his staff. That's 100% for sure. I don't have any interest in that. But it's interesting because my brother's an excellent coach, and he's always been an opposite personality.
He took over a tough situation. I admire that. I really admire the situation he went into.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, my brother had coached junior, and he won the Memorial Cup. So he's won the Memorial Cup 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
He's a super hardworking guy. He reminds me of like a Rod Brendamore, you know, just always, you know, could do penalty kill. He was fast, just a hardworking guy. All the his teammates and coaching staff loved having him around. And, you know, he's just really great with that age group too, the teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
So him being head coach in the NHL works out great. So I always encourage him. But, yeah, I mean, the coaching career at the young age is tough because, you know you're going to have to move around too. So I think that sort of can weigh on him sometimes when he thinks about long-term coaching. Right? Because you know how the coaching carousel can go. You're probably going to move around 7 or 8 times, right? And, you know, he's sort of at that decision now where I guess he's 30 now. And it's like, okay, do I pick a career where I'm going to be consistently coaching, but I'm going to be moving consistently, likely? Or, you know, do I do something else or just stay in the junior ranks and, you know, enjoy that?
Just so everyone knows, Kyle's brother, Eric, is the head coach of the Flint Firebirds of the OHL. Before we let you go, and you're being very generous with your time, I know it's very early where you are right now, Kyle. There is a time difference, and we appreciate you getting up for us. I'm just on the website right now, and it is headcheckhealth.com. End-to-end solutions to execute concussion protocols. You've been with this group for a while. Can you give us a snapshot or a couple of words on what exactly HeadCheck Health is all about?
We make managing concussions much easier. And, you know, there's many different users. You know, there's a parent guardian, there's the athlete, there's different medical professionals, there's volunteers on the sidelines, there's, you know, commissioners, there's, you know, medical professionals that want to write the concussion policy. So there's all these different touch points just for users, and they all need different information. And we, you know, give reports to the commissioner. We make sure the protocol is being followed the way that medical professionals would like. We make that easy to do for, you know, the athletes and the people on the sidelines. And we work with, I think, about 800 organizations now, including, you know, Major League Soccer and the CFL and the Canadian Junior Hockey League. So, you know, we've moved forward with that, and it's been a big learning experience. And, you know, I think that a lot of times with software, when it's working well, nobody comes back to you with anything. And, you know, like I said, how many have we managed already? And I haven't had an athlete or a parent or an agent ever call me. So it's like, hey, what's this you guys are doing, right? Like sometimes they get onboarded and things are working and nobody ever says like, oh, that was great that you've got that, or tell me a little bit more about that. So I really just don't think people know. So it's an interesting thing for sure.
HeadCheckHealth.com @HeadCheckHealth is the Twitter feed. Final word, Elliot?
Yeah, I just want to ask you one more question, Kyle. It's kind of about that. Like there's a lot of talk about concussion health now, and there's no question we're more aware. And this week there was a big story done on the use of painkillers, and painkillers have definitely become an issue. And I think CBD is going to become something that people start to use a lot more because it seems to be healthier. Do you believe that people who want to be athletes, elite level athletes, are more careful about this? Is there still the attitude that to be successful, I'm going to have to ignore and overcome a lot of things, and I'm just going to push through it?
That's a tough question. I think that they will always look to push through it. I mean, I had the painkillers when I was had my 3 surgeries, and the first 2 I took them, and the 3rd one I wouldn't touch them because, you know, it does affect you trying to do your rehab and practice. It's like you had no idea how powerful the painkillers were, and it was difficult to do anything on them. So, and I remember friends who were, you know, had different jobs at construction and whatnot, they were taking painkillers just because it was so hard, their jobs. So I think that, yeah, people are looking for different solutions, but the jobs will probably be the same and they'll have the same issues. So I definitely would hope that people take the painkillers very seriously and, you know, only take them when they're absolutely necessary for sure.
Absolutely. Kyle, this has been real nice. Thanks so much for spending time today. Continued success with HeadCheck Health, and we'll hopefully catch up sooner than later. Thanks so much for dropping by.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
I want to thank Kyle Wellwood for stopping by the podcast this week. What a nice man. Like, what a nice, gentle man. Really talented hockey player. Ridiculous hands, Elliot, as we all saw when he played in the NHL. And someone that would go about his business, you know, pick up assists, great playmaker, scored the odd goal, really creative, and not pick up any penalties at all along the way. You know, here's a guy that went through a stretch of, I think it was like 150 games without a penalty. I think it was one, maybe 2 years in the OHL when completely penalty free. When I say the name Kyle Wellwood, what comes to your mind, however?
It's kind of hard to explain, Jeff, but he's a guy who did it his way. Like, he was his own guy. Whenever we talked to him, he kind of always had this smirk.
Yep.
And yep. I like that because, like, you could tell he was like, okay, I got to fit into the team concept and I've got to do these kinds of things, but I am going to do this my own way. And he was kind of like his own guy. And it's like we talked about in the interview about how he never had to work hard. He was gifted and he was like, yeah, that's just me. I accept who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's hard to explain, but I've always kind of been fascinated by those kinds of people. Like, as a person with no talent, I could never get away with things on talent alone. So I legitimately always hated people like that who just got by like he did.
So skilled. I want to wrap up the conversation about Wellwood by asking you to thank me for something I didn't do.
Okay.
Because I was about to go down the really hockey geeky rabbit hole of two-piece sticks, because I think he was one of the last ones to use it in the NHL.
Well, you should have. Like, some people are going to find that interesting. They're weird, but they might find it interesting.
I love stuff like that, but I've made a conscious decision to try not to be that guy every week here on this podcast. I got to pick my spots a little better. But I think he was one of the last guys to use the two-piece stick. I don't know who. Someone out there will know. Who was the last to finally give up the two-piece? But I think he was one of the last ones in the NHL. Elliot, great job this week. Anything we've either left hanging out there that you want to mention on the podcast, or are we wrapping her up kind of early this week?
I got to tell you, I had some people reach out about the Laviolette interview last week.
Yeah.
And just say that's going to be the last 30-minute interview he gives anyone ever.
Why is that?
Because he just doesn't like to talk that long.
I thought you were going to say because he went out of his way to embarrass his kid at the end with the interview about the hockey tryouts.
No, I
tryouts.
Thought that was a funny story. But no, it's just that apparently he's not a guy who really likes to talk a lot.
I don't know, man. He was great. He was chatty.
He was excellent. He was
fantastic. Conversational. It was that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun there with him. All right, so we thank again Kyle Wellwood for stopping by this week. We're going to wrap up with an artist that we've featured before. And we're happy to feature him again because he's up to something pretty cool. Hawksley Workman, and I can't say that name without humming Battleford's in my head. That's a song that we featured, I believe, in season one of 31 Thoughts, the podcast. It is outstanding. And the minute I stop recording this extra, I'm going to listen to it. Hawksley Workman is now live streaming an entertaining 75-minute music and variety show live from his Peterborough, Ontario home. Hawksley Night in Canada features hits, quips, live call-ins, and custom-penned songs about Elliot's pets. It's really good. Next live stream is tonight, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Link to the Hawksley Night in Canada stream. It's in our show description. Speaking of show description, by the way, we have timestamps now for various content. You asked and Emil delivered. We do now have tags. Here's Hawksley's latest single, Dwindling Beauty, on 31 Thoughts, the podcast.
I think the universe is trying to tell me nothing. I think we both feel it'd be best if we walked away. And all the wives are drinking with their say. Oh. Like maybe it's run out of good things to say.